On the eve of this great adventure, I send my best wishes to every soldier in the Allied team. To us is given the honor of striking a blow for freedom which will live in history. And in the better days that lie ahead, men will speak with pride of our doings. We have a great and a righteous cause. Let us pray that the Lord, mighty in battle, will go forth with our armies, and that his special providence will aid us in the struggle. I want every soldier to know that I have complete confidence in the successful outcome of the operations that we are now about to begin. With stout hearts and with enthusiasm for the contest, let us go forward to victory.
Now the ships are sealed and we wait. Troops swarmed up the rope ladders last night. Strong, healthy, formidable men, many of them going into battle for the first time. At every minute of the day and the night, the ship and the men aboard her are alert. Plans of immense complexity are being studied, and every man, soldier or sailor, is learning to the last detail the part that he himself has to play. As you walk along the decks, men are reading, or sleeping, or talking in small clusters. Across the water, we can hear the jazz from a minesweeper's gramophone. There's a tenseness in the air as every man aboard waits for the moment to which everything has been bent in these last few years. Sometimes they talk of home. An hour ago, the mail came in, and for a few minutes, another world, 3,000 and more miles away. And then they were here again. Here, wondering and waiting and ready. Ready for the night, not far ahead now, when we sail from Britain under a full moon, with course set for France. It's 20 minutes to 8 in the evening, and Matt and I have only a few hours to H hour. At any time now, we may see action. At any moment, the German advanced defenses may come into play. And so, while we steam steadily along a course that's carrying us south towards the Seine, I'm taking this chance of recording. At noon today, we raised anchor, and we were ready to go. Slowly and majestically, as minesweepers and destroyers curved their way into position, we gave the lead to the other transports. Under a grey sky, we looked at the coast of Britain and watched it slowly grow more dim. On the decks and in the holds, the soldiers were waiting. For the most part, standing about, looking out to sea, talking now and then, and thinking. In the wardroom, dinner. From the menu, soup, roast beef and green peas, and apples and cream, it might have been a crossing to Cherbourg in peacetime. And then you realized that your hand was moving just a little sluggishly to your mouth. Your tummy wasn't just where it usually was. The men around you were rather silent, and when they spoke, they were self-conscious. It was a room full of men on the way, wondering, waiting, and listening. On deck, signals were flashing between ships. Enterprise had run up a flag signal. Boat crews were making their final preparations. There was a tenseness and a sense of good humor and good fellowship that were impossible of translation into words. And now, as the time draws near for darkness, and we sail steadily nearer to the coastline of France, most of those same things are still happening. Every man is wondering. Every man is completely calm.
The day has broken now. The day has become clear. The sky is blue, although there's still a good deal of cloud about, and the sun is streaming through. The whole sea is a glittering expanse of green with white crests everywhere. And everywhere, too, there are ships. Every kind of ship one can imagine that would be needed in an invasion. There are all our landing craft for tanks, for infantry, for every type of supplies. There are great troop ships in great number. There are battleships, smaller warships, destroyers, patrol craft, escort ships, and in the sky overhead there are aircraft of about half a dozen different kinds that I can see at this moment. One could not imagine a more stupendous scene. All of these ships, all taking their various parts in this invasion. The whole sea itself seems restless and excited with the tension of the moment. The sky sky is moving and changing the whole time in a high wind that is sweeping. And in this dramatic natural setting, we are moving towards the shore. The battleships and other bombardment ships over on the flank are pouring in their fire. And now other warships moving across our path are laying a smoke screen that is taking the place of the cloud which formerly lay over the waters. A dense smoke screen over on one quarter. And now there's a signal from the flagship.
All hands to beaching station.
All hands to beaching station. That's the signal for our sailors on board this craft to get ready for the landing. This is the day and this is the hour. The sky is lightening. Lightening over the coast of Europe as we go in. The sky is lighter and the sea is brighter, but along the shore there's a dense smoke screen as the battleships and the warships, the smaller warships, sweep along there, firing all the time against the shore and some of them laying a smoke screen for us. The sun is blazing down brightly now. It's almost like an omen, the way it suddenly come out just as we were going in. The whole sky is bright, the sea is a glittering mass of silver, with all these craft of every kind moving across it, and the great battleships in the background blazing away at the shore. There go the craft past us, the other landing craft. Some are left behind, the slower ones, each taking their part and going in at the right time for their right job. Destroyers, corvettes, patrol buses. I can hear the sound of anti-aircraft fire. I can't see yet whether it's our people who are being attacked. There's an enormous cloud of smoke along the shore, not only from the smoke screen, but from this terrific bombardment. All the ships are blazing away now. All around this enormous circle, there are ships. Ships moving in, ships on patrol, ships circling, ships standing to and firing. We are passing close by a cruiser that has been taking part in the bombardment, but is now on, I imagine, a sort of general patrol. You can't imagine anything like this march of ships, like soldiers marching in line. I've never seen anything so expressive of intense. It's a purpose shared among many ships and among many hundreds of thousands of fighting men who are going in now to the coast of Europe to do the biggest job they've ever had to do. I can't record any more now because the time has come for me to get my kit on my back and get ready to step off on that shore. And it's a great day.
This is London. London calling in the home, overseas and European services of the BBC and through United Nations Radio Mediterranean. And this is John Snagg speaking. Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, have just issued communique number one, and in a few seconds I will read it to you. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. I'll repeat that communique. Communique number one. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
The build-up is going well. I spent some hours on the beaches this morning watching men, food, ammunition and supplies come streaming in. It's a combined operation between Navy, Army and Merchant Navy. The effort is enormous, the results in some cases staggering. I talked to the principal beachmaster on one sector, a tall, bearded naval lieutenant commander. Our conversation was punctuated by the orders he gave to craft shouted through a loud hailer. Keep to windward there, 1047. Keep clear of the duck entrance. Next moment, he was dictating signals to be flashed by lamp along the beach. He was answering army officers, queries about the tide and obstructions. But he was right on top of the job. His men, Royal Naval Commandos, some of them, were busy clearing wrecked landing craft and marking with red flags new traffic lanes through the shallows. And up and down those lanes, almost as though on conveyor belts, the regular steady stream of ducks was moving. Hundreds of them. They went out empty from the shore, changed from wheel drive to propeller a few yards out and made track, or rather wakes, for the merchantman lying 2 or 3 miles out to sea. Down the next door lane, they were coming inshore, reversing the process and driving their piled cargoes of sugar crates, tires, petrol, shells up the coast road to the depot.
We're on our way out south from the coast, crossing over towards Normandy with a wing of Spitfires on its way to take over the patrol and the protection of the Allied armies on the beaches and inland. This must be the first time that anyone like me has been able to call you from a formation of fighters, single-engine aircraft which can't take a passenger. The only reason that I'm here is because I'm traveling in a Mosquito which can carry a second person, and we have tacked ourselves onto the back of the fighter formation. We're heading straight out now. A very lovely sight the Spitfires are on our port side, ranged in their ranks of three. Now, as we fly closer into the coast of France, we're pulling away to starboard and overtaking the formation of Spitfires, hanging there so perfect, almost motionless in the wonderful clear air. Down below us, on the surface of the glistening sea, the everlasting procession of ships going to France. There they are in a line, with their silver wakes coming out behind them. So stately, and apparently to us so slow. We're flying at about 250 miles an hour, straight in towards France. Spitfires on the left behind us. And somewhere with us, one other Mosquito, gone out of sight at the moment, who's flying with us as another extra machine with the formation. But for years, I've been used to describing things, but I find it difficult to tell you just how this looks. In front of the great mass of shipping, there's the great pattern of France, cratered and re-cratered where our bombs have fallen in the past. Here is the new landing strip, lying out, looking for all the world like an old established and magnificently prepared aerodrome. We're diving down and coming in over it right now, flying straight over the top. And there, in the distance, and all round us, as though in a great semicircle, is the battlefront. I can see the whole of it from east to west. Fires are burning in every direction. There's smoke going up in clouds. We've seen the guns firing and the ships firing inshore. And we're flying so low now that I can see individual people on the ground. There are anti-aircraft guns. There are some cows sitting in a field. I'm describing them all as they go past the port side window of this Mosquito cockpit. More guns. And there are transport on the road. And at that road junction, just below us, there's a military policeman waving him on. You know, I can even see his red cap from here, but he's wearing that and not his tin hat. The roads are full of our transport. All our chaps driving on the right-hand side in the continental style.
I'm lying down at full length here in the cornfield. Just in the hedges around me, I can see many men taking shelter behind the banks wearing their steel helmets while this terrific barrage goes on around us.
I've just stepped off one of the motor torpedo boats of the Light Coastal Forces, which last night bored in north of Cherbourg and engaged enemy E-boats attempting to filter through to the beachhead anchorage. At the briefing yesterday afternoon, the young skippers of these crafts were told that the E-boats had to be engaged and sent to the bottom. Those were the instructions in a nutshell. Shortly afterwards, the MTBs were scorching out across the channel, sitting on their tails, sending out that well-known fountain of a bow wave and testing their guns. The skipper of this boat is a lieutenant commander, DSO, and last night I saw why. That man's a fire eater. He just doesn't know what duck means. It wasn't long after midnight when one of his exploratory star shells revealed the low silhouettes of a batch of E-boats. He opened fire with everything he had, and that's plenty. But in the darkness, the enemy got away. The second battle occurred under a newly risen moon, and the E-boats got the drop on us. It was a short, sharp, running fight. The odds were at least 5-2 in the enemy's favor, and once again we lost them. The third and last tussle came about 4 in the morning. It was a honey. I can't begin to describe to you what the decks of one of these little fighting boats is like while a thing like that's going on. The thud and concussion and chatter of guns just beggars description. There were 6 E-boats. We were 2 at that juncture. Tracer was sailing just over our heads and fore and aft of the ship. Our fire was directed at the second in line of the enemy, and a murderous fire it was. I was standing beside a 19 years old gunner whose rich Scots accents leave no doubt about his native heath. As he poured his fire in at the enemy, a little lick of flame shot from her hull, and then bigger tongues of flame. My little Scots gunner had his teeth clenched and his thumbs on the firing buttons. As he saw the flame, he ground out, "Burn, you unprintable name, you burn," and burn she did. By the time she was a completely enveloped funeral pyre, the other five E-boats had withdrawn into the night. In the glare cast by those flames, they must have been able to see us, but they had had enough. Ammunition and signal flares were going up from the blazing hull.
2 hours ago, I was looking at Caen Cathedral, standing up gray and soft in the light of the sun. We were flying into France at 200 miles an hour to attack an important concentration of German tanks of the 21st Panzer Division gathered in the path of the Allied armies advancing beneath us. It was the first daylight operation of the British tactical bombers since D-Day, and if successful, might have important effects on the progress of the land battle. We had left the coast of England, flying in a tight formation, so tight that I could see the features of the pilot flying the Mitchell bomber on our right hand. Above us, behind, in front, and below, the Spitfires escorting us were flashing by, wheeling and banking and rising and falling as they scoured the sky for the Luftwaffe. There was cloud at first, white woolly cloud over which we flew in the brilliant sun. But as we approached the channel, it broke into patches, and through a big gap, I saw the shining blue sea. Not an empty sea, but a sea crowded, infested with craft of every kind. Little ships, fast and impatient, scurrying like water beetles to and fro, and leaving a glistening wake behind them. Bigger ships in stately, slow procession, with the sweepers in front, and the escort vessels on the flank. It was a brave, oh, an inspiring sight. We are supplying the beaches all right, no doubt of that. We flew on, southwest, and I could see France and Britain, and I realized how very near to you all at home in England is this great battle in Normandy. It's a stone's throw across the gleaming water, and as we left the thick cloud behind us, I saw it all as a mighty panorama, clear and etched in its detail. There were the supply ships, the destroyers, the torpedo boats, the assault craft, leaving England. Halfway over was another great flotilla, and near it a huge, rounded, ugly capital ship, broadside on to France. And there in the distance was the Cherbourg Peninsula, Cherbourg itself revealed in the sun. And there, right ahead now, as we reset course, the beaches. Dozens, scores, hundreds of craft lying close inshore, pontoons and jetties being lined up to make a new harbour where 6 days ago there was an empty stretch of shore. There were the vehicles making their way inland, a great fire burning to starboard, the guns in action there too, jets and puffs of bursting shells. We were sweeping inland, swinging round again, now heading straight for the road junction and the tiny village where the panzers were sheltering. No time now to watch for enemy fighters. Let the flashing, wheeling Spitfires do that. We watched the ground, intently. We were over the German army. Our own lay behind. I saw two trucks driving down a road. But behind us, a Dutch pilot saw a long column of German transport moving up. From an enemy aerodrome to starboard came puffs of flak, below and behind us, not near enough to worry about. France was green and glistening. I glanced across at the pilot of the next Mitchell. He was having a good look down, too. Then we went in, straight as a die. We were very near the extreme forward Allied units, and I wondered if they were watching us. We were quite a pretty picture. The bomb doors were open, and before I expected it, our bombs were away, and at the same moment, all the other Mitchells following in our formation let go, and I saw the green and brown bombs sailing down. "Watch 'em," said the wing commander. I was watching, over his shoulder as he banked to port. We waited. What a long time bombs take to go down. And then there was a shout. The whole area of the road junction had erupted. Fountains of earth and smoke and dust and flame shot up and hung in the evening sunlight like poplar trees. The village and the German armor were hidden in the chaos. "Bang on," said the wing commander. "Bang on," said the voice of the Dutch navigator in my ears. And we turned for home. Out over the beaches, the ships again, and Caen lying there so still. No sign of fighting in the city, no sign of damage to the cathedral. And then back over the water, past Le Havre with its pattern of docks and wharves, back over the channel and over the sheltering clouds again. But not before I had one glorious view of the home coastline stretching for miles to the east and west. You know, Shakespeare was exactly right. This country is a jewel set in the Silver Sea. But the Silver Sea today is as the poet could never have seen it. Alive with the ships of Britain, America, and our allies, and ours to command.
A little further up the road, and a bent old woman in a black shawl bids us good day. She stayed in bed through it all, she says, but the ceiling fell in on top of her, and now she's no habitable home. So much the worse, monsieur, but it can't be helped. And she wanders on down the street. We come into the market square. The little restaurant au gourmet has no spécialité alimentaire to offer today, but Monsieur le Patron stands smiling a bit ruefully outside his broken shop window while a French tricolour drapes down from the floor above. Our troops, tin-hatted and dusty, are everywhere about, clearing debris, mingling with the inhabitants, passing through in truckloads. A sergeant falls in his section just in front of the war memorial, a plain bronze obelisk, quite undamaged, with Bernier's last war roll of honour. Behind it, the church has a shell hole through its tapering steeple, and we learn that a few hours before, two snipers were winkled out from it with the help of a naval gun. We learn, too, that more snipers are about in the town, and we're advised to go warily. Inside, the church is almost undamaged, and a mounting heap of fresh white flowers adorns a shrine, while a statue of Joan of Arc in shining armour looks down from a niche in the wall. We leave the market square and walk along a roadway to the east. There, in one of the big gardens, are three British privates stalking through the bushes with rifles at the ready. Snipers suspected, the sentry tells us. But in the orchard beyond, a flock of young lambs are frisking and playing quite unconcerned. There's a notice now on the roadside. Roads and verge cleared to next village. We walk on, past some of our signalmen who are running wires between the telephone poles from which the lines are dangling in a tangled skein. We find a holiday camp at the fringe of the town, obviously used latterly as a German barracks, with small arms ammo left there, beside piles of mine warning notices, and under a bell that's marked in German, gas alarm. There's a cow munching quietly in a stall, a donkey beside it, and across the courtyard, rows of rabbit hutches with their occupants, unaware perhaps of being spared their intended fate as a German dinner dish. The broken windows of the straggling buildings creak and rattle in the breeze. Perhaps with snipers about, it's not quite such a healthy place. We move on, and suddenly, where the houses thin out, we catch a glimpse of the anchorage. From the shore side, it looks more than ever crowded. In fact, there are so many ships and craft that there's not much sea at all to look at. We hitchhike now on a duck going west to Courseulles. It seems less damaged in our bombardment than Bernier. Not that that was by any means demolished, but here there are many more houses quite intact. It's a bigger town, of course, with a little port, and there are more inhabitants to be seen about. Again, there's military traffic driving in convoys through the streets, driving on the right-hand side of the road, continental fashion. The inhabitants, as before, give us smiles and waves and bonjour. A priest offers us food or lodging. There's a small boy poking his head through the bars of a wrought-iron gate, munching away at a piece of bread spread liberally with army ration jam. We wander on through the town. Life doesn't seem so very abnormal. A barber invites us in for a shave, and just at that moment, the guns from one of our cruisers in the bay open up and shells go hurtling overhead. We think they might unsteady his hands. We decline politely and wander on, gradually making our way back towards the beaches again.
The curé of this little Normandy church, 2 or 3 miles from Caen, wants me to say how sorry he is about these bells. His village has only just been liberated, and it's taken until yesterday to clean up the many German snipers left in hiding. When I asked the curé if we might record the bells of his church ringing in celebration of the village's freedom, he asked me to wait for a week, and this is why. They used to have a very lovely little carillon in this church. Only 3 bells, but they were very proud of it, and many of the villagers were expert bell ringers. But when the Allies freed the village, 3 German snipers hid in the square tower of the church, and for 2 nights they were very troublesome. At last they gave themselves up, but it was found that they had smashed the big bell of the carillon. Monsieur le Curé promised that if I would only wait a week, he would have the big bell repaired, and you could hear the full carillon. But he added that in any case, they were going to ring the remaining 2 bells at once this morning to celebrate our coming. And I thought that you would rather hear the bells now, even though the big one has been smashed by the Germans, to let you know that the people of Normandy are celebrating their liberation, that church bells are ringing, and the villagers are going to mass to give thanks for their freedom.